Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, Adam, we get to talk with Duke Associate Professor, Director of the Duke ALS Clinic and founder of ALS Untangled, Dr. Richard Bedlock, about ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease.
You know, Christy, we talked a long time about doing a show on ALS, and I'm really excited. It's a devastating disease for so many listeners, so many families across America. And I think this will be a helpful show to allow us to begin to understand it better.
But first, we have some research that matters, and we're going to talk about family doctors treating simple sleep apnea.
About breast cancer and high-fat dairy food.
About babies and stress in the womb.
And finally, if you had a loved one that had to have cardiopulmonary resuscitation or CPR, would you want to actually watch it being done? The results may surprise you.
Well, let's jump right in. And this first one is about sleep apnea, which affects a lot of people where people during the night, during sleep, stop breathing for short periods of time when the airway collapses, sometimes snore a lot and are noticed to have these times without breathing.
And frequently, Christy, we both know that the way this is set up is people get tested for this, and then if the tests are positive, they get started with specialized equipment. The problem is that the testing can be really expensive. So one of the questions is, can many patients or some patients get actually diagnosed and started treating in their family physician's office with family physicians perhaps who have some additional training in nurses? And that's what this research looks to answer.
They followed 155 people who had sleep apnea over 6 months to see if those who were treated by family doctors who had received a brief training regimen about treating sleep apnea to see if their care was just as effective as people who were treated by sleep specialists.
And these primary care doctors, these family doctors, after they got the training, they were able to offer home diagnostic testing rather than testing within a sleep lab to have this starting of this CPAP or this special treatment for sleep apnea to help the breathing, and then a special jaw splint to help the patient kind of keep their upper airway open. These are standard kinds of treatments.
Basically, as they followed the people over 6 months, the average daytime tiredness score fell in both groups and really looked as though the care was the same, but yet taking care of patients in the primary care setting saved about 40% in cost compared to the patients who went to a sleep specialist. So that was pretty remarkable.
Yeah, $1,600, which is still expensive for a primary care doctor to treat one of these patients with sleep apnea compared to $2,600 for a specialist. And I guess I, Chris, even though it was 40% difference, I thought this was not as great of a change as I would have thought. And this was a clinical trial where we know kind of those family docs were getting the best training and the best outcomes. And I guess I'm a little bit doubtful as to whether or not this can be as easily translated into practice.
Well, I was encouraged by it mainly because it takes a long time to get a sleep study, and wouldn't it be nice if patients could get it in their own home, in their own bed, instead of sleeping in a sleep lab? So there's some potential for making this more, making it easier for the patients. And I would love to have that training to be able to do it, but you know, it's one of those things where if it requires special equipment and special training, it's hard to know if that's going to be applicable to everybody.
Yeah, one more thing that the family doc has to do. What I'd love to see is to see the neurologist working with the family doctors and doing this at home and reducing the cost. That's the research I want to see.
That's what I'm talking about, too.
Let's talk about our next research that matters.
Okay, this is about breast cancer and diet. So, I mean, we have many, many, many breast cancer survivors who are interested in ways to extend their life, to keep that breast cancer behind them, and are interested in relationships between diet and what they eat and their risk for survival. So this is a study pertinent to lots of people.
Yes, and this article is in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute. And we should have mentioned the last article, Christy, was in the Journal of the American Medical Association. So these are some major journals. And in this particular study, they really wanted to see, are those women who are consuming high-fat diets, what's their risk of dying from breast cancer compared to those who have very low-fat diets?
So they looked at about 1,900 women who were breast cancer survivors who averaged as little as one serving a day of really high-fat dairy foods and found that the folks who averaged even one serving a day of those high-fat dairy foods, being cheese, ice cream, really high-fat milk, had a 49% higher risk of dying from breast cancer than those who ate none or very little of those high-fat dairy foods.
Right, and the absolute risk was not as great, but it still was a significant improvement. And the question is, did this improvement come from a lower-fat diet per se, or is it due to perhaps the hormones that are in the higher-fat diet? What do you think?
Well, I think because there is also an association with prostate cancer and some other hormone-related cancers, and this kind of high-fat dairy stuff, the fact that it has estrogen in it, it makes sense that that somehow plays a role.
Yeah, I think the take-home here is that if you have breast cancer, if you're at risk for breast cancer, you should really take to heart this idea of lower-fat diets. You probably live longer, and you might not die or have less likelihood of dying cancer. I don't see a whole downside here.
I don't. Just learn to like skim milk. That's hard.
My daughter's teaching me.
Good. Okay.
Let's talk about our very next research that matters, which is stress on babies before they're born. Does it matter?
Well, a lot of people talk about this, that stress during pregnancy can be harmful to babies, but there's not a lot of really good evidence to link that in a meaningful way. And this was a study looking at female mice to see if exposure to various stressors, like the smell of a fox, during the first week of pregnancy made a difference compared with mice who were not exposed to those kinds of stressful things.
And this research in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, you might say it's female mice exposed to foxes is not very nice. At least in
that rhymed.
Offspring, because they found this gene called OGT, and I'm not going to say what that is. That's a long name, but it's the OGT in the placentas of the mothers that were exposed to the stress. These female mice were lower than the non-stressed group. And we know that this is associated with worse outcomes.
Well, and so the theory is that the OGT levels go down, and that that is necessary to help protect developing brains. So if the OGT levels go low because of stress, that the offspring then become more vulnerable to certain problems. And one of the hypotheses was a risk of schizophrenia
or even autism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, you know, we don't usually present too much research about mice and fox odors and being exposed, but I think we do believe that health starts from the time that someone is born to the time they die, and also during pregnancy at a very, very early stages. And if there are ways of stress being important to a healthy offspring and reducing those stress levels, we're all for it.
Yeah, I think we need a lot more information to be able to guide this on an actionable level. But paying attention to stress and trying to find ways to reduce stress in your life is a good thing for everybody. Let's do our last one.
Yeah, speaking of stress, our very last research on cardiopulmonary resuscitation, and this was actually in the New England Journal of Medicine. And whether would you, if you had a relative that was really sick and needed to have CPR, would you want to actually watch it being done or not? I was surprised.
This was a study looking at, to see in France to see if in 266 cases they were asked if they wanted to watch. The family was asked, did they want to watch the CPR? And in that case, someone chose to watch in almost 80% of the time. But then there, in the other cases where no effort was made to ask the family if they wanted to listen, about 43% someone chose to watch it. But the interesting part is what happens down the road.
Well, yeah, I mean, the survival rate was very small, those people. So this was not necessarily, was the care any different or was survival any different? But what was the rate of post-traumatic stress disorder, that rate of those who are surviving, the family members, how traumatic did they feel 6 months later? And it turned out that those who witnessed the CPR being done had less of this trauma months later than those who did. That, to me, was surprising.
It was surprising. Somehow watching that at least helped them realize that a lot of effort was put into trying to save their loved one. And maybe that somehow helped with healing. And I think it was important to note that they didn't find any increased stress on the healthcare workers or influence of it, no influence on whether or not the person survived, and no lawsuits related to it.
Now, this was done in France. Not
yes.
that we don't have, we're biased against anything overseas, but there may be a different cultural aspect. And then there were also these emergency teams. They were really equipped with these mobile intensive care units, and they were staffed by a doctor or nurse, and there was someone available to explain this as it was happening. I think in a lot of places where we'd be thinking about in the hospital, it's not so, it'd be much more chaotic.
Absolutely.
We need more research here. But if you were requesting it, and it happened to your loved one, it's probably not unreasonable.
Well, we've had a chance to talk briefly about seeing failed CPR of a loved one potentially helping you cope, about babies potentially being affected by stress in the womb.
And avoiding that box odor at the very least. really avoiding high-fat dairy foods if you've been diagnosed with cancers.
And finally, potential that family docs can treat simple sleep apnea at a lower cost. So that concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Richard Bedlack about ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy and I are going to be talking with Duke Associate Professor and Director of the Duke ALS Clinic and founder of ALS Untangled, Dr. Richard Bedlack, about ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Bedlack.
Thanks for having me here, Adam.
Thanks for being with us. We'd love to hear how you became interested in Lou Gehrig's disease, such a difficult thing to be passionate about. Certainly grateful for that. How did this become your passion?
Well, I guess in order to tell you that story, I have to tell you how I became interested in neurology in the first place.
Okay, give it to us.
So when I was a kid, for some reason, I always was attracted to manifestations of the nervous system, whether it was compensating for something healthy, like rolling my little brother down the hill in our backyard and watching him kind of get up and stagger to one side and wondering what was going on, or being out at the movies and watching people with abnormal walks and having my mother slap my hand and say, you're not supposed to stare at people. Hmm. For some reason, it always interested me. And as I was going through my training, I just gravitated more and more toward that. And finally, one day, saw in clinic as a medical student, my first patient with ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease. And to me, it was the most amazing and terrible thing I'd ever seen.
That combination of horror, but yet fascination.
And, you know, I still have that every time I see a case. It's still, to me, the most dramatic neurological exam And it's also the most terrifying thing to watch as a physician. I mean, the disease really makes me feel powerless at times.
Well, let's translate for our listeners who may have heard of Lou Gehrig's disease or ALS. What exactly is it?
So it's a degenerative disease, and it's fairly specific for motor neurons.
What does that mean?
Yeah, those are the nerve cells that allow you to move your muscles. They're kind of like the wires that connect the front of your brain where you decide to do things to the muscles that actually carry out the actions. And people affected by ALS or Lou Gehrig's gradually lose those. And so over a period of a few years, they lose the ability to walk, to write, to feed themselves, to dress, to speak, to swallow, and eventually to breathe. And unfortunately, within about 3 years of symptom onset, patients have to decide between death and being supported on a mechanical ventilator.
You know, I know this disease from patients that I've had and family members is so terrifying. And that ALS or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, and we'll have to put that on our website because it's hard to spell, much less say, but it does mean this muscle that doesn't have nourishment and dies. How did ALS get its name? Because we call it Lou Gehrig's disease, but let's not assume that everyone knows about Lou Gehrig.
Right. So it actually was named by a French neurologist named Charcot in the late 1800s. The term amyotrophic, myo means muscle, trophic means growth factor. And so Charcot noticed that his patient's muscles were shriveling up, and he hypothesized that that was because of the loss of some underlying growth factor. And then lateral sclerosis, because when his patients died and he did an autopsy and took out their spinal cords, the sides of the spinal cord were stiff. They were sclerotic, scarred down. So that's where the name comes from. But as you've pointed out, it's a difficult thing to pronounce. And so it's pretty safe to say, I think, that once somebody famous got the disease at the height of their popularity, it became better known by that person's name. And that was really Lou Gehrig. That was the first really famous person in the United States to come down with this disease at the height of his career.
And, I mean, considering how frightening it is, who gets this? And how do they usually present to a physician?
Well, that's part of what makes it so scary. So there's a wide range of ages. On average, people are about 60 years old when they get this, but the youngest person I've seen is 15, and the oldest person is 90. And although there is a familial form where there are genes, that only accounts for somewhere on the order of 15 to 20% of all cases of ALS. The great majority, we don't know why people get them. And so it really can strike anyone at any age for no apparent reason.
And how common is it?
Luckily, it's not that common. There's probably about 6,000 new cases of ALS in the United States every year. And there probably are somewhere on the order of 30 to 40,000 people living with the disease in this country right now.
Well, you know, I imagine that for listeners and even doctors, when you wake up and you feel something you haven't felt before, it's really scary. And I think of multiple sclerosis as one of those diseases that it's really scary if you think you might have it. And people know a lot of people maybe who have multiple sclerosis. How does one, if one is worried, I mean, this is a hard diagnosis. How do you make a diagnosis?
So believe it or not, the diagnosis is still purely clinical, not very different from the way Charcot made his diagnoses back in the late 1800s. We have to actually find what we call lower motor neuron signs, which means on exam, we have to see muscle atrophy, twitching, and weakness. And we have to have what are called upper motor neuron signs, which means we have to have spastic muscle tone and increased reflexes. We have to see those in multiple parts of the body, and we have to rule out every other possible explanation for that combination of lower and upper motor neuron signs. We're really trying hard to find a better way to make a diagnosis, because with this method, it takes on average about a year from symptom onset for us to get a diagnosis of ALS.
And then if it progresses that quickly in 3 years, as you were saying, that's well into the course.
Yeah, Christy, so there's a lot of problems with this diagnostic delay. I mean, one is that, you know, as you've already pointed out, by the time we get a diagnosis, many patients are already one third of the way through their disease. Another problem, just from a research standpoint, is that by the time we can diagnose somebody with ALS and get them into a research study, we think that they've lost about half their motor neuron pool. Mm. So if we're trying to find treatments that, you know, preserve the motor neuron pool, we're already way behind the eight ball unless we can get a faster diagnosis somehow.
I mean, I know we'll probably take a break in a minute, but one of the things I'm sure we'll come back to is that this has to be a family disease. This is not just the patient, because of the implications of not so many treatments and how difficult it can be towards the end. Do you, when you are really about to give a diagnosis, do you almost always bring the family in together? Is this really different than many other things?
Yeah, we really don't like to give this diagnosis to someone either over the phone or even in person if they're alone. So we do try to have, you know, family and friends with the patient when we give this diagnosis. And we also make sure that after we've explained the disease to someone, explained, you know, what it's going to do to them, that we also leave some room for hope and optimism. Things really are a lot better with ALS than they were when I started the ALS clinic in the year 2000. We've got a lot of little things that we do that prolong survival and improve quality of life. And there's a lot of exciting research studies going on right now. So there's real reason to be hopeful and optimistic in ALS right now.
I think we have time to start on those things briefly. Could you maybe touch on one example of what you could offer someone to give them that kind of small hope?
Absolutely. So first of all, we can talk about the variability in the disease itself. You know, many times people come in and they already suspect that they have this when we tell them. I mean, they've already done some reading, or someone might have told them that they had it before, and they've done some reading and they're under the impression that every single person only lives 2 to 3 years from the time that they get their first symptoms. And that's not true. There's a wide variability in how fast this disease progresses. So, I mean, I've got patients in my clinic who were diagnosed in the 1980s who continue to come. One of the most famous people that's living with ALS is a physicist named Stephen Hawking. He was actually diagnosed with ALS at the age of 19, and he just turned 70.
Wow.
So people can live a long time with this disease. It's just, it's not the norm.
And do we know why there's that variability, or we really don't know?
We're starting to just understand a little bit of that. So clearly there's some genetic factors. And in the past few years, we have found two genes that seem to be slightly different in people who live much longer than average. One is called KIFAP3, and the other one is called FA4. And as we start to understand what those genes do, hopefully we'll be able to tip the scales towards slow progression in everybody.
Wow. Well, that's exciting to hear that there is hope yet to be shared with these families. We do need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Dr. Richard Bedlack about ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Duke Associate Professor and Neurologist, Director of the Duke ALS Clinical Program, Dr. Richard Bedlack, about ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. Dr. Bedlack, right before we broke, you were talking about if someone's recently diagnosed, that you can give them and offer them perhaps a little more hope than you could have a decade ago. What are the range of things that you will tell a patient about possible treatment?
Thanks, Adam. So first of all, we have a medication now which is called Riluzole or Riluatec. It's a glutamate antagonist. Glutamate is an excitatory amino acid neurotransmitter that seems to be present at too high of a level in the brains and spinal cords of patients with ALS. It's probably one of 1,000 different things that are going wrong. It's not the only thing that's going wrong. And so with that medication, we can give people an extra few months of life, but it's better than what we used to have when we first opened, which was no medication at all. So at least patients can take that and feel like they're doing something to slow the disease down some. More importantly, we've developed a special way of taking care of people with ALS. It's called a multidisciplinary clinic. And so at Duke, we actually have one of the largest multidisciplinary clinics in the world. It consists not only of myself, the neurologist, but a nurse practitioner, 3 different speech therapists, each of whom has their own sort of area of focus. One is on communication, one is on environmental controls, and one is on swallowing. A nutrition therapist, a respiratory therapist, occupational therapist, physical therapist, social worker, and a research nurse. And all of these people see every patient every time they come. So a patient will come and every few months spend most of the day with us getting literally gone over from head to toe. The purpose of all this is to identify what the disease is doing to different parts of the body and to be able to suggest some ways of compensating for it. There is no right answer in terms of, you know, what which one of these things each person should pick. It's up to them, but we want to be able to provide people with the maximum number of options. And some of these options are really extraordinary. So for example, for communication, the most amazing thing that we had when I first started were devices where, you know, people could type or maybe use head movements to move a cursor on a computer screen and slowly spell things out. Then we developed an interface where people could actually use eye gaze. They could move their eyes and there'd be a tiny camera in their glasses that picked up the movements of their pupil, translated those to the movements of a cursor on a computer screen. And when they blink, it's kind of like clicking the mouse. Now we're on the cusp of having something even more amazing, which is a brain-computer interface. So people with ALS will eventually be able to put this cap on. And with some training, we'll be able to pick up their brainwave activity. And they'll be able to move a cursor on a computer screen with no body movement whatsoever, just by activating the brain in a certain way.
Wow. So these are pretty high-tech and comprehensive strategies to improve quality of life, it sounds like, mm-hmm. for people with this illness.
That's right, Christy. So all these little things that we do, it's very clear that patients who come to clinics like this have much better quality of life scores over the course of their disease than patients who just, you know, go and see sort of the old model, just see their neurologist every few months alone. But amazingly, they also have longer lives. So patients with ALS who come to multidisciplinary clinics live about 9 months longer than patients who don't.
Is that partly because of that medicine, or do you think it's somehow related with depression or something else?
I think it's independent of the medicine. So I think the biggest thing is that we pick up on a lot of small things. So we prevent complications like falls. We might pick up on things like deep vein thromboses faster. And also, I hope that we're fostering a spirit of you know, optimism and excitement in the clinic that might not be there elsewhere.
You know, it sounds like the patient-centered medical home for ALS, or the things that are near and dear to us about chronic disease care, and it sounds like it's essential because the social support alone is worth the price of admission.
Yes, I would agree with that. And that's something that I did not appreciate when I first started in my career. You know, Adam, I first started in my career and I was really focused on the science of ALS and, you know, evidence-based medicine and trying to fight this disease with science and technology. And I became very enamored with trying to measure the effects of the disease scientifically in people that came to clinic, and took great pride in being able to slow weight loss and optimize PCO2 levels. And the more I go in this right now, until we have better therapies, the more I realize the most powerful weapons I have to offer against ALS are optimism and hope.
Well, you're doing something unique I wanted to ask you a question about, which is this: starting this kind of newsletter, this ALS alert, to really look at not just what people are taking as prescribed by physicians, but a lot of alternative therapy. Because I can imagine with the disease that there's not a lot of treatment, and that is mostly universally killing people within 5-10 years, a lot of people are looking for alternatives. Tell us about that newsletter and what y'all are doing.
Yeah, so the program is actually called ALS Untangled. And as you've pointed out, it started out with just recognizing in clinic that this was a terrible disease, and that although we have a slowly growing number of options to offer, you know, the stuff that we have is just not all that powerful. And so it's you know, not surprising that people would reach out on the internet and try to find something better than what mainstream medicine has. And we call these non-mainstream things alternative and off-label therapies, or AOTs. And so if you do surveys of patients or their physicians, it turns out about 50% of patients with ALS will try at least one of these AOTs over the course of their illness. And so you might say, well, you know, what's the problem with it? I mean, what's the harm? In fact, many times patients will say that to me after they present me with an idea that they might want to try. What, I already have ALS, what further harm could come to me?
Like what? Just give us an example.
Well, so for example, someone might come and say, I read on the internet that you guys are doing a trial of this drug, NP001, and that drug, it looks like the formulation of it is something called sodium chlorite, And there's somebody on a website who has figured out that we can buy sodium chloride. It's sold as an industrial water bleaching agent. And he's got a formula on there for a certain number of dilutions. And we can take that stuff orally. And we don't even have to worry about being in the study. We can just take it. And hopefully that'll slow down ALS like you're theorizing it might do in your trial. And so this is an example of some of the potential harms that can come. So first of all, people are making these decisions based upon limited information that's not been vetted by any sort of scientist or clinician. So who knows, you know, who this person is on this particular website and whether this dilution makes any sense. And in fact, it turns out that's one of the ones that we scientifically investigated, and we found out that there's no evidence that sodium chloride can be absorbed orally. And studies of it have shown that it probably isn't absorbed. In fact, it's converted in acidic environments into chlorine dioxide, which is a poisonous gas. So not only is there evidence that it probably wouldn't have any chance of working, but also that it could potentially be very harmful if taken in the wrong dose. So part of the problem with the internet is that there's no internet police. So people can just say whatever they want. You can build a clinic and it can sell things like herbal therapy or chelation. And you can write on there, you know, people are coming here with ALS and they're getting better. And no one's ever been harmed. And no one can challenge those statements. I mean, there's no internet police to go out to the clinic and say, well, where are these patients? Can I actually see their records and prove they had ALS?
And they could just be preying on people with a certain disease without a cure in order to get these scams through. I do want, before we wrap up, to have a chance to talk about what is on the horizon that is starting to become science or evidence. What as you look 5 or 10 years ahead, is there hope for?
Well, look, I'll say two things. So first of all, with ALS Untangled, we started out by just trying to be fact checkers, just trying to develop a systematic way to assess these AOTs and make sure that patients had all the right information. And we've surprisingly found some things that might work. So one of the strangest things we found is coconut oil. So somebody came to me one day and said, I saw this amazing video on the internet about an OBGYN physician who was treating her husband who had Alzheimer's with coconut oil, and he was getting dramatically better. So can I try that for my ALS? And the first thought would be, of course, well, why would you try coconut oil for ALS? It makes no sense. Well, it turns out that it actually does make some sense. So coconut oil is medium-chain triglycerides. Those are converted over to ketone bodies in vivo. And it turns out that one of the problems we have in ALS is a mitochondrial dysfunction, meaning that motor neurons cannot produce energy properly. If you gave them an alternative source of energy, such as ketone bodies, they might actually be able to work better for a while. And you can show that in a dish, that motor neurons in a dish given ketone bodies with mitochondrial dysfunction can survive longer. And so it seems that there's probably no side effects to coconut oil except maybe diarrhea. And since constipation is so common in ALS anyway, it might actually be a double whammy. But, you know, beyond things we found, there is a very exciting pipeline in ALS. So some of the most exciting things that are happening right now, we are going after events that occur in cells that live next to motor neurons. And that's based on some animal work in which they were able to selectively repair the genetic defect in different cell types and see what that would do to the survival of the animal. And so if they selectively repair the genetic defect in these animals in motor neurons, they got almost no effect on survival. But if they selectively repair the genetic defect in something called microglia, little Pac-Man-like cells that live next to motor neurons, they got a really dramatic improvement in survival, better than any drug we ever saw.
Well, I know that some of our older listeners would know what Pac-Man is. it's a good thing when you can eat and devour those cells. But we really want to thank you, Dr. Badlak. I mean, we've kind of scratched the surface because we really could talk about it. Do you want to get diagnosed with genetic therapy if you had a relative that had this, and all kinds of other issues? And so I'm sure we're going to have part two of this story somewhere down the line in the not too distant future, if you're willing.
I'd love to come back. As you can tell, I like to talk about this stuff.
Well, it's important, and I know our patients who have kinds of diseases like this will ask us about things, you know, vitamin B12 and herbal therapies. And so we now at least know where to go, and we'll link to your website for those providers who perhaps need and want to be able to get more information as well.
Thanks, Adam. Yeah, we'll be happy to investigate anyone's ideas. www.alsuntangled.org.
Thank you.
Well, we want to thank Dr. Richard Badlak, the director of the Duke ALS Clinic, for talking with your health listeners about ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease. We're going to take a short break. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we'll spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
And Christy, we have some great House Calls today about B12, about should you stop aspirin for colonoscopy,
about antibiotics and sinus infections,
and about allergic reactions to sulfa drugs. Well, let's listen to our very first House Call about B12.
My B12 is around 250, and my doctor recommended a supplement, but I've heard that B12 injections are better and can also help with weight loss. Can you tell me if they work?
What do you think, Christy?
Well, I think I couldn't recommend B12 injections for help with weight loss at this point. There's really not any solid evidence that that makes a difference.
Yeah, I agree with you. And, you know, my first actually question is, you know, do you have low B12? That, you know, your blood level is kind of borderline here. So my first thing is I'd repeat your B12 level. If indeed you do have a low B12 level, you might need a B12 supplement, but not necessarily for weight loss.
I completely agree with you. But I do want to just congratulate and commend this listener for making an effort with weight loss and really exploring what it'll take, because for most of us who need to work on this, losing some weight will make a difference in your health. So keep at it one way or another.
And last thing, most people who actually need B12 really don't get it reliably from supplements. They do need injections. So if you really did have a B12 deficiency, that's something you want to talk with your doctor about. Let's listen to our very next House Call.
I'll be having my first colonoscopy soon, and I read that there's a risk of bleeding. Should I discontinue my daily aspirin before the procedure?
That is a very good question, and one that you should talk with your doctor about. And Adam, it'll be interesting to see if we agree on this. From my perspective, if you are just taking a baby aspirin for general prevention because you're 50 and a man and your doctor has told you you should, or other risk factors, then I think it's reasonable to stop that aspirin about a week before the colonoscopy if you can. But if you're on it after you've had a stroke or on blood thinners for some other reason, then I would recommend you really talk with your doctor about the pros and cons of that.
I agree with you entirely, Christy. One way we think about this is sometimes having a high risk and a low risk patient in a high risk and low risk procedure. So that low risk patient, Christy, you just talked about, couldn't agree with you more. A high risk patient, someone who's had strokes, really needs to stay on it. A high-risk procedure is this colonoscopy in which they take out a large polyp. That doesn't happen very often. Most times it's a minor biopsy, if anything, and that's a low-risk procedure in most patients. So talk with your doctor, but in this particular case, I agree with you. If you didn't have any high-risk problems, you could stop the aspirin.
All right, let's take our next House Call about sinus and antibiotics.
It seems like every time my grandmother goes to the doctor, she comes home with an antibiotic to treat a sinus flare-up. But my doctor always says most sinus infections don't require antibiotics. Should we speak with her doctor? I'm worried about her taking so many medications.
I don't know if we should say anything about grandmother's doctor, Christy.
I don't either, but we can say that there are recommendations that in the current evidence, in this current climate, that physicians should not routinely prescribe antibiotics for sinusitis unless the symptoms are going on for more than 7 days or if they get worse after they initially get better. But most of these infections are from a virus.
Couldn't agree with you more. And as to whether or not you should speak with your grandmother's doctor, well, I don't think we really are in a position to say that. Other than if you're ever concerned about the care that a loved one gets, you should probably speak to their doctor. But I think you're going to have to talk with your grandmother first to get her permission. I wouldn't go over the grandmother's head and try to talk behind the you know, and to get in there. That wouldn't be a good thing.
I would totally agree with you, Adam. Let's take our last house call question of the day.
I had a severe allergic reaction to a sulfa drug when I was younger, but I haven't had any trouble since then other than bad seasonal allergies. Should I still be carrying an EpiPen?
Well, you had an allergic reaction to a sulfa drug. That sounds like it could be miserable, and those can be really severe.
And I think it depends on what happened to you and the likeliness of you coming in contact with that again. For people who have severe peanut allergies or allergies to bee stings, having that EpiPen is so important because bees and peanuts or some peanut contaminants are everywhere. So that could happen to you even if you were just out and about. Taking a sulfa drug may be a little bit different in terms of sort of having an awareness of what's happening.
Yeah, I was a little surprised because we wouldn't typically give an EpiPen for a sulfa reaction. We would just tell you to avoid sulfa. And the most likely cause that you're going to get exposed to it is medication, a prescription antibiotic. The other things that you might get sulfa in, there's some medications that your doctor may give you for certain conditions, but the likelihood of a severe reaction from those is very little. So the short answer is you probably don't need to be carrying an EpiPen. Certainly would talk with your doctor or your allergist, and so glad that you're actually doing better now.
Yep. We've had great questions today about B12 and aspirin and colonoscopy.
About talking with your grandmother, if not her doctor.
And about EpiPens and severe allergic reactions. Thanks for your questions and for joining us today on Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and your health. We want you to share your questions and stories. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or download our health app.
And we'd like to thank WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, our guest today, Dr. Richard Bedlock, and we hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. We'll talk with you again next week.
Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.